Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're considering the fallout of the United Kingdom's extraordinary referendum vote to leave the European Union. We'll be gauging the economic impact, of course, in the UK and across the continent, but we'll also analyse the broader political and social ramifications and try to make sense of what the future, near and far, might hold. We start with an assessment of the immediate aftermath of the so-called Brexit. From a European perspective, were the reactions in terms of the macro picture in line with expectations? Ricardo Garcia is head of European economics at the UBS Chief Investment Office.
If you look at the first reaction in the markets, that was pretty much in line. We had a lot of trades in the market betting on a remain, given the change in dynamics in the polls just ahead of the referendum. Nonetheless, the strength of the markets in the last few days, i.e. this week, is partially surprising, although we think that it probably will take some time until all in the market have made a final assessment of what that means.
Dean Turner is economist and director in the UBS UK CIO. Did what we saw sit with Dean's expectations too?
Prior to the referendum, we had published our forecasts and in the event of a vote to leave, and certainly for sterling.
In market terms, yes, things went much as anticipated, says Jeffrey Yu, ultra-high net worth investment strategist for UBS Wealth Management. But there have been some domestic political shifts that have been rather more surprising.
Clearly, we are seeing some realignments happen both within individual parties and in the wider sense. And this perhaps has added to worries within markets of when a decision on how to proceed in terms of the UK's negotiations with the European Union are going to happen. So that is clearly weighing on markets as well. But again, in the grand scheme of things, I think markets have spent the weekend also to look at things as rationally as possible and on an asset allocation basis, also advocating not to take any rash steps.
Caroline Simmons is a strategist for CIO, UBS Wealth Management, and she brings us the equity picture.
The financial markets were clearly not priced for the leave outcome that manifested. However, what is interesting is that the markets have been reacting in what I would say is a relatively rational manner to that surprise outcome. You know, we thought that if it was a leave scenario, that domestic stocks, cyclical stocks, financial stocks would probably underperform the market, and that areas of the UK equity market that had more exposure to international earnings, particularly the dollar, that would benefit from the fact that the pound had weakened, and also areas in more stable defensive sectors less linked to GDP would be outperforming. And that's exactly what we've seen. Year to date, we've now got the domestic exposed basket of stocks, if you like, is underperforming the market by about 17%, and the US exposed basket's outperforming by about 5%. So that is a sensible reaction, I guess, from the market with regards to the fact that GDP forecasts are now being lowered for the UK in the coming quarters.
Now, it's an often repeated fact that the markets hate uncertainty, volatility, unpredictability, whether economic or explicitly political in character. Here in the UK, we seem to have created almost a perfect storm of these various uncertainties. So, in the medium term, are we in for necessarily torrid times? Here's Dean Turner again.
I think the impact will be felt principally in the next couple of quarters, whilst both the UK and the EU settle on their negotiating position. That period of uncertainty is not likely to be welcomed by businesses or consumers. Therefore, we expect that economic growth will be hit quite sharply. In the next couple of quarters, we're actually forecasting that the UK economy grows at 0% in the next quarters. Beyond that, we should see a modest recovery from there. But it's unlikely we get any reduction in uncertainty until we actually get some idea from leaders in the UK, whoever they may be, as to what the likely roadmap is from here, what's the likely shape of any future relationship, trade relationship in particular, the UK has with its largest trading partner, the European Union, and also some stability on the political backdrop. It's far from clear who's going to actually be leading the country through these negotiations, but it's also unclear as yet who's leading the opposition.
We've talked before on the programme about pricing in uncertainty, but how do we price in the time frame in this case, as unprecedented as it is? Here's Jeffrey Yu.
2 years or to five. 5 years out, then that requires changes or at least a review of capital market assumptions. And again, at this point, we don't think that is the case. I highly doubt that any new Tory government would try to drag things out for as long as possible. So it's clear that certain discussions are happening behind the scenes at this point. So what we're witnessing is just things bubbling to the surface. But I think you do make a wider point about political disruptions. I mean, if we think of Brexit as one data point, this is probably the latest in the series of populist challenges against the status quo, right? And so we're seeing similar trends within the US right now, and this makes November's elections extremely interesting. Next year, we've got elections in France and Germany as well. There's a referendum in Italy later this year. So all this put together, rather than capital market assumptions, I think people want to make new assumptions on how politics, especially populism, impacts mainstream, the decision-making, how that will ultimately impact central banks as well and their policy reaction function and also financial markets.
Let's get more of the European view now from Ricardo Garcia. Ricardo has some interesting perspectives on the medium-term implications for regional growth. He stresses the importance in particular of sentiment.
We have just updated our forecast and we did reduce our forecast down. Nonetheless, we didn't mark them down heavily.
And another European view, this time from Monocle's Brussels correspondent, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson.
The European Union, like most things, is not united on this either. There's two camps emerging, really. One, led by the European Parliament, actually, and a few member states, is really demanding Britain to trigger that Article 50 and start exit proceeding straight away. But the other faction, led there by Germany, by Angela Merkel, is arguing for a little bit more time to calm the situation a little bit and to give the British government time to put itself out before officially coming to that negotiating table. The feeling at the moment is that they probably will give the UK until October, when there's a new Conservative Party leader, a new Prime Minister, and potentially to the end of the year. But we are seeing some quite different statements coming out about that as well. But one thing that we are seeing quite a united front on is that there can be no soft negotiations, no start to talks until that Article 50 is triggered. David Cameron and his successor are not going to be allowed to sort of test the ground to see what they can and can't do before they actually start officially negotiating their exit from the European Union.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll consider the validity of suggestions that the Brexit vote could cast the very future of the whole European project into question. Plus, we'll get the inside view from here in London of Monocle's editors and friends on the social and indeed some emotional consequences of the referendum. Turning next to a narrative that has had some traction in the past week or so, namely the idea that Brexit heralds the collapse of the whole European project. It's far too soon for that sort of rhetoric, says Dean Turner.
Certainly we expect a fairly robust response from the European Union in order to continue with the project there. That said, we think it's unlikely that, at least in economic terms, the European Union will escape any form of disruption. That said, the direct linkages with the UK, and given the relatively robust backdrop for certainly domestic demand in the Eurozone, does suggest that any hit to output should be relatively limited. Now, there is potential downside to that view, and that would come from because it's very difficult to get a sense of how uncertainty could affect businesses and consumers in the euro area, well, just the UK. But our sense is that certainly from a European and even a global perspective, that any hit should be manageable. And we should bear in mind that we are in a position where central banks globally are in a position to provide continued support to the global economy.
And Geoffrey Yu is another to suggest taking a step back. Sure, discuss the risks of an unravelling, but do keep some perspective.
It's important to, again, take a step back and be as level-headed about it as possible and view things on an idiosyncratic basis. If you believe that, take Holland for example, the threshold for calling a referendum is actually quite low given their new legislation, but for a country who's in the Eurozone, by the way, and bulk of their trade goes to the rest of the European Union, the size of their economy and also geography and things like that, much smaller compared to the UK, and if you really weigh the Euroscepticism, is that actually that strong compared to the UK? And it's important to bear in mind the UK is always considered to be somewhat of a detached member of the European Union as opposed to other founding members who are at the core of the European Union, at least in a political sense, right? So can we draw direct extrapolation from what's happened in the UK and say there will be similar winning majorities in other Eurozone countries? I think that is a bit too far. It's important to talk about these developments. It's important to discuss the risk and perhaps factor that in to your allocation, but saying it's absolutely going to happen, sell the euro right now, I think that's getting a bit ahead of ourselves right now.
Before mentioning collapse, it's critical, says Ricardo Garcia, to remember that the European Council position says very much the contrary.
Well, actually, we got some more information and clarity on this question in the last European Council, so the gathering of the heads of state of the European Union. And it crystallized that actually the heads of state want to take the European Union further. So it didn't lead to a situation where everybody says, let's put everything on hold and think about what this all means. No, to the contrary, they remain committed and united to continue their projects. And also, as you mentioned, the Netherlands and Sweden, the respective heads of state, also said just after the referendum that they do not intend to hold a referenda on EU membership. Now, our view has been already before the referenda that the likelihood of other referenda in all member states is relatively low in the short term, given the lack of parliamentary majorities. Nonetheless, we have to keep in mind that we have a lot of elections in the next 2 years. Just to name a few examples, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, we just had now, and then also the Netherlands. This could obviously change the probabilities of these referenda. When we think about the Netherlands, but in particular France, where the head of the Front National has actually explicitly said that she not only wants to have the same referendum in France, but also in other member states.
Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Xenia Wickett, head of the US and Americas programme at Chatham House, share their views on the respective positions of various European leaders. Here's Isabel Hilton first.
What's interesting, I think, is that you can see their respective interests emerging. So Merkel with Germany, you know, Britain's a big trade partner of Germany, and Merkel has always been sympathetic to Britain, more so than the traditional Franco-German axis in the EU. She's the voice of moderation. Meanwhile, you've got Hollande, a deeply unpopular president, facing an enormous challenge from both the centre-right and the far-right in France, and with a more Eurosceptic population, according to the polls, than the Brits are. So he's coming out with a very hard line. You've got to go quickly, enough. But I don't think anyone really expects anything to happen quickly. And certainly the British are in no position to make anything happen quickly.
The big challenge that we face now, that both the Leavers and the Remainers face, is that their supporters are hugely diverse. As Isabel says, you've got some people who want little England, who want to close down the borders and just be England and we can stand alone, or
England,
Great Britain.
England of the 1950s.
Exactly. You know, or maybe Great Britain, but probably England, and stand alone. And then you've got other people who see the EU as constraining Great Britain, and therefore the loss of the EU means you can have a greater, better, bigger Britain that is more inclusive, that trades more with everybody, not just the EU. And so you've got people within the Leave campaign who have wildly different views. You have people within the Remain campaign who also have wildly different views about why one should remain. And they represent actually the same kind of phenomena that you're seeing in the United States today, a kind of disenfranchised, which is a significant minority / majority, the disenfranchised, and those who have benefited through globalization, through engagement, through internationalization, et cetera, et cetera. And if you wanted to see, as I say, not glass half full, but if you wanted to see a positive, that is blatantly apparent. We can no longer pretend it isn't happening. And therefore, actually, can we grasp that? Can our politicians grasp that and do something about the fact that there's huge divisions in society today? And that the reason we are where we are is because of those huge divisions.
Xenia Wickett. In the aftermath of the Brexit vote, many, including those of us who call the city home, were prompted to ask, whither London? Andrew Tuck, the editor of Monocle, was far from alone when he articulated a deep sense of disappointment with the result and a still more profound sense of personal disengagement from the many here in the UK who voted to leave.
many of the things that we're very, very passionate about have been undone in one fell swoop. You know, this is a magazine that for the last 10 years has said to people, you know, get off your backsides, go around the world, find places to settle, start new businesses, meet different people. Don't feel that you're tied down by your nationality just doing one thing. You know, and the amazing thing is, you know, whether I was going to do it or not, you know, I knew always that if I fancied it, I could get up tomorrow, move to Berlin, open a company, employ people, and there was no one could stop me. That was my right. I could do that within Europe. I had an access to a world of opportunity and excitement and culture that was truly, truly exciting. And we're about to lose all that. We're going to get to the stage where people have to apply for visas and permission to go and live places. You know, we've got a generation of kids who can get on a train, go to Paris and study. They don't have to ask permission. They can just go and do it. They can go and learn French. They can take a job there for the summer. They don't have to ask permission. And now suddenly, whether you're, you know, a teenager, you know, somebody in midlife who fancies a bit of a life change, or you're working in banking, that is going to change. Whether we like it a lot or not, that is going to change. And that world of opportunity and ambition, I think it's stealing it from a generation. And that those are the things that people haven't thought about. All those things are going to hit home. And lastly, you know, when I look at the people in our office, you know, we've got people here from, you know, Italy, from Portugal, you know, who came to the UK because they wanted to do better for themselves. They wanted careers. And speaking to them today, you know, that feeling of, you know, what does this mean? You know, there's no guarantee what we're going to do for these people. There's an air of uncertainty. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in London and across the UK who are here doing amazing jobs, doing incredible things. And we've put a question mark next to every single one of them. And we've made every single one of them think, you know, they're not quite welcome. And I think, you know, that, you know, I'm kind of angry about it. I feel this is not in my name.
Dean Turner from UBS is another sat in London, looking at the city specifically. Where does he think it stands? 2 years hence? Five. Can London stand its ground as a financial centre?
London does face a challenging time. The financial services sector will be hit by the uncertainty, and it seems likely that there will be certain elements of activity that could be transferred across to the European Union. And it's too early to come to the conclusion that it's going to be a particularly negative outcome for the City of London. The question over passporting rights is going to be crucial for how the City of London copes. But even beyond that, we must bear in mind that the City of London has faced crisis before and it's rebounded from those. It's incredibly innovative and imaginative. And factors that have made London a success over the past decade, namely highly educated, very deep talent pool, very strong infrastructure, and a highly flexible, motivated workforce, don't change just because of this decision. So although at the margin things could be possibly favourable, certainly not completely negative outcome.
Lance Price was Director of Communications for the Labour Party under Tony Blair. He summed up what the vote means for London, its place in the UK and in this debate. He also expands on how the issue of migrants and immigration, often the fear rather than the experience, informed the outcome.
London is a huge sort of vortex that sucks in wealth, sucks in people from all around the world and certainly from all around Europe, that has a completely differently structured, differently financed economy to the rest of the United Kingdom, which thrives on its multiculturalism, on its multi-ethnic makeup, and prospers because of its outward-looking nature. And you don't have to travel very far from London. I'm from the southeast of England, but it doesn't matter which direction you head in, to find a very, very different sort of country. And very often, I mean, migration, immigration was clearly one of the major concerns of those people who voted to leave. And a lot of the polling, I mean, I'm as we all should be now, sceptical of the opinion polls. They let us down during the general election. They let us down to a certain extent last night. But there is evidence that people's concerns about immigration are often highest in the places where there are the fewest non-white British people living. It's a fear rather than a direct experience, which is not to diminish the fact that in many areas, because we haven't really come onto this yet, but in many traditional working class labour supporting areas where they do have direct experience of immigration, then there are real concerns about pressures on the health service, pressures on the education service, and so on and so forth. Most of which, not exclusively, I mean, those pressures exist in London as well, but people living in London are partly because of their incomes, partly because of the nature of the capital.
We end this edition of the programme by considering some of the key takeaways in the eyes of our experts and analysts. First, that critical issue of freedom of movement and how it informs nations' access to the single market. Could perhaps free movement of labour differ from free movement of people in future? Here's Dean Turner.
Perhaps free movement of labour could be considered something completely different to free movement of people. So there is some debate as to whether the former is still compatible with gaining single market access than perhaps the current situation. But you're absolutely right in identifying that immigration was one of the key issues in this debate. Therefore, it is going to be one of the bigger challenges that's going to have to be negotiated in due course.
Malcolm Rifkind, the Conservative former Foreign Secretary and Defence Secretary, shares his view on the big picture and possible future ramifications for the United Kingdom.
So often we're told there's a north-south divide in Britain. A bit difficult on this occasion. The two parts of the country that were most pro-Europe were the very north, that is Scotland, and the very south, that is London. You know, so you could say, well, yeah, and it's the bits in between that mainly voted no, and they happen to be a majority. We've had referendums before. We have general elections. And the reason we have more than one political party is because people have different priorities and different preferences. All democracies are divided, just as all other societies. You don't expect 100% agreement on any subject. I don't believe it's stronger. I voted the other way, and I'm deeply disappointed that we didn't win. So I'm not going to pretend it's all good news. It's not good news. However, things are never as bad as you fear, nor as good as you hope. And the decision having been taken, we're a very democratic country. A majority voted to leave. The rest of us will accept that. And we all now have the same interest in trying to make Britain at least as prosperous, at least as strong, at least as influential in the wider world as it has been until now. Now, that'll be a challenge. It's not certain we'll succeed. But we're more likely to succeed if all in Britain work together for that purpose. And now that the issue has been of our membership of the EU has been decided, that particular issue, which up for many years has divided people in Britain as well as dividing Britain from the European Union, we can now put behind us. That will be a decision we don't intend to revisit.
Much of the discussion has been, quite understandably, downcast. And despite an initially sanguine response in the markets, there's much gloom predicted. But are there any little chinks of light? In equity terms, we've seen travails in retail banking, in aviation, housing, all sectors where something of a decline was perhaps predictable. And the British Chancellor himself, George Osborne, says the UK will be much poorer as a result of Brexit. So does UBS's Caroline Simmons see any light ahead?
It depends very much on your time frame, but you know what financial markets react to is generally the nearer term, so you know maybe 6 months, maybe 12 months, and not a whole load more beyond that. You know, what we've done with our GDP forecast, so we think the second half is closer to zero, so that brings GDP for the full year 16 to 0.7%. So it's quite a big downgrade from where we were, but it's still not disastrous, and it's certainly not levels of GDP that we encountered during the financial crisis, for example, which was more like -6%. So, you know, it's negative from where we thought we were headed, but it's not negative relative to the scale of the financial crisis, for example.
And a last word to Ricardo Garcia. He explains that at least this shock came in a moment of relative economic strength for the bloc.
The good thing is that this shock hits the eurozone in a moment of strength. So data has been very good in the eurozone the last 6 months. We had in the winter the best quarter in half a decade. So it's coming in a good moment, so to speak. So we do have some caution here. On a more negative note, we would caution about a too optimistic interpretation of the European Council. As the heads of state, while they were saying that the UK remains a friend and that they want to retain a close cooperation also in the future, they also made clear that there is no flexibility in terms of the four freedoms of the EU, which includes also immigration, which means that basically the UK and the government will have basically to square the circle.
And that's Ricardo Garcia bringing us to the end of this 91st edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via your usual platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.